You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
You're listening to the ESPN Footy Podcast.
G'day guys and welcome back to another episode of Red Time. We have an exciting slate of topics to get through today, leading into round three, an Easter weekend of footy. I'm your host, Jared Barker, and as always, ESPN's Jake Michaels is with me. Jake, hello to you.
How you going? Well, you say as always for myself, but...
Well, you are on always.
Right? I know, but... Yeah. Well, I am. But you're leaving me next week. Is that true?
I won't be here next week. Matt will be. Your good friend will be back.
So
the Tuesday boys will be on the Thursday as well.
You've already squared that off with him, have you?
I have. But no, I won't be here. I'll be in cold freezing New Zealand, so it should be good. Are you an Easter fan?
As in the holiday?
Holiday, I guess.
Yeah, not a huge fan.
I don't take
fan.
You for like a chocolate eater, given all the marathons you run.
No, I used to eat quite a bit, but not as much anymore. I try and watch the waistline. But no, we'll certainly be watching quite a lot of footy. I love the actual Easter weekend of footy because it's one of the most spread out.
Thursday through to Monday.
Yeah, yep. It's great.
Yep. Plenty on the agenda, guys, including Peter Wright, that decision from the AFL Tribunal. Some decisions at Tigerlands will come under the microscope today, some ball chip technology and what the most valuable position on the ground is as well. But first, some explosive revelations overnight, Jake. And just for some background, some claims were made by Federal MP Andrew Wilkie in Parliament on Tuesday night of players faking injury to stay out of games and avoid random drug testing that may return a positive sample and incur a match day Sport Integrity Australia ban, as advised by club doctors. These are serious claims, and Simon Goodwin on Wednesday was asked, and he said he has no knowledge of that happening. Tom Harley of the Swans saying likewise. Jake, this is a very complex issue. What are your main takeaways from what's come out so far?
Wow, I mean, yeah, where do you even begin? So many takeaways, so many thoughts. As a lot of people probably have as well. I guess the number one thing that sort of springs to mind when I read about this and hear about this, and I guess there is the caveat that we don't know 100% if these claims were 100% true in terms of the faking of the injuries. But with that said, that is the concern. That is the primary concern, that we are lying to everybody if, and yet again, there is a big if, that is the case. That can't happen. I think it's as simple as that. We can't be lying to everybody in football, whether it's not just media, it's fans, it's everyone that has any kind of vested interest in the sport, to be lied to about what's happening. If that's the case, that's really concerning. That cannot continue, I don't think.
Well, the AFL's illicit drug policy will come under question now, as is expected. It's a policy that deals with the use of illicit substances, but out of competition, and is focused on the player's health and well-being. Now, because it's out of competition, it's not necessarily a Sport Integrity Australia issue, formerly known as ASADA. So I just want to take you through part of the AFL's statement from Wednesday, just to make things clear. This is what they have admitted. If the test shows a substance is still in the player's system, a doctor will take steps to prevent a player from taking part in either training and or an AFL match, both for their own health and welfare, and because having illicit substances in your system on match day may be deemed performance enhancing and a breach of the Australian Football Anti-Doping Code. So this is highly complex, Jake, and as I said, the drug policy, which is, they're still working under the strike system. This all remains to be seen, whether they stick with that. But the AFL has to do something about this, as you said. It's a moral and society issue. that the AFL is always going to have to deal with, it seems.
Yeah, and look, the AFL has come out and they're unapologetic about what's happening, but that's not overly surprising because if they did come out and apologise, then they're admitting to fault. I guess another sort of takeaway from it is just because something isn't illegal doesn't mean it should be done. I think that applies in all walks of life and certainly very much so here as well.
Yeah.
It's not that it's a loophole. It's that they can get away with doing it and they want to do it. They'll say that it's for player health and well-being, but they don't want that look. They don't want to have to be associated with so much of this in the sport. They don't want to be seen like other sports where it's a serious issue, when I think everyone knows that it really is, and it is quite prevalent in the sport. And you speak to people and players, and they'll tell you that it is a prevalent concerning issue in the sport. So there are a lot of different things here. I think the other part of it is that you mentioned, because the AFL will say that it's all about the health and well-being of the players. They'll always frame it that way. But is there a concern, even a slight 1% concern in your mind, that because of these revelations, and if these are to become true, and even if not, now that they're out there public, everyone's aware of this, and there'll be, this will cross people's minds when they see any insert player X on the injury list for an upcoming game.
Importantly, the AFL didn't come out and deny that necessarily, which is really important.
Yeah.
And I think that's quite damning.
Yeah. So if, for example, Patrick Cripps is at training and hurts his shoulder, and they think, oh, we probably err on the side of caution, you know, sit him out for the week.
Yeah.
Is there going to be a concern with doing that? Because the clubs will think that this could actually be happening.
Mm.
And the questions that would be thrown at them about Patrick Cripps and the way it would be perceived by fans about Patrick Cripps.
Yep.
Is there a concern, or is that a ridiculous way to look at it? I don't think it is ridiculous. And then that leads to them saying, well, let's just play him, which then leads to injuries because players shouldn't be playing because they are actually injured with legitimate injuries, not fake ones. So, yeah, it might seem like a crazy thing, but I think by saying that it's all for the players and their health and well-being, I don't necessarily think it could go that way. I think it could go the other way.
You're right. It comes down to more of a public relations and media thing now with club statements when a player is injured. I don't think they're going to keep a player or play a player that's injured to avoid that sort of discussion that they
don't want. But depending
on
the degree of the injury, it's one thing if it's we're watching a game in round five and
it's the minor niggles.
He pulls his hamstring. We know he's done his hamstring.
It's the minor niggles. I tweaked his ankle during the week, but he's fine.
It's the minor stuff that happens at training that 99.9% of fans don't see and are totally unaware of until the team sheet is announced. And that is where I think you'll start to get those questions.
It's fascinating stuff. And I don't think we actually can avoid that sort of stuff, unfortunately.
And we have to keep putting in these caveats of if, because
correct,
we don't know 100%, as you've alluded to.
Yep.
The AFL has come out and released that statement, but in no way has the league denied anything that was mentioned last night, which does kind of give you the indication that it probably does happen. Moving on, Peter Wright. So was going to be our lead topic of the day, but
the ever-evolving world of the AFL.
That's it. There's always something else. Peter Wright received a 4-week suspension last night at the AFL Tribunal for his bump on Harry Cunningham that left him concussed.
Mm.
Was it the right decision?
I think they got the decision right based on the new way that they assess these incidents now and the seriousness of these concussion lawsuits. They don't really have a choice now, the AFL, but to suspend those collisions. So even though the tribunal acknowledged that there was an element of bracing for contact, the reality is players need to now attack contests differently.
Mm.
That's what we're facing right now. And it's going to be bloody difficult, but...
Well, how long is it going to take for players to adjust to that?
I don't know.
Because I think that's something we can expect to be just an overnight instant fix.
It's not. There's going to be a lot of suspensions this year, I feel. And what I'm concerned with is, if Peter Wright doesn't protect himself the way that he did, because he did, that human instinct of bracing for contact to protect yourself, if he doesn't do that in that split second and we teach the players to keep your hands up, make sure you're going for the mark, it opens yourself up for injury, I would have thought. So look, the game's clearly changed. It's a brand new era of Aussie rules, and I think we all need to get used to it. But under the rules, to answer your question, the 4 weeks is right, but I hate the idea of the AFL thinking when a player gets concussed, you have to suspend someone. And while this action can be suspendable, I get it, someone this year is going to cop a ban for something so incredibly minor, and only then will we be up in arms. That's what I'm fearful of. So the AFL got this right, but that doesn't mean there isn't a little part of me that's concerned about where the game is actually going.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And I think I mentioned it quite a few times that I'm a big believer in punish the action as opposed to the outcome. I think I said it last week on here, and I've said it numerous times over the years. And I truly believe that it's the action we want to get rid of. The outcome is a lot of the time down to chance. We could see the exact same scenario this week, and the Harry Cunningham player isn't left concussed, and it is a totally different situation with how it's handled. So that to me is the concerning part. I don't think that action should be met with a 4 week suspension. I think that's incredibly harsh. But it does come down to what happens and the result of how Cunningham was
Is the AFL
concussed.
Trying to avoid the unavoidable? Because players are going to get concussed from ways that we don't even know about yet.
What do you mean?
Well, I can kick a footy and my boot can come flying off and concuss someone. So concussion's always going to exist. I know that's just a sensationalist thing for me to say.
But
the reality is we
don't
know how players can get concussed. Yeah. And concussion's just going to always exist, which sucks.
The other thing is, I mean, I'm no doctor, but I know that if you're someone who has had concussion in the past or concussions, you're far more likely, I think it's 10 times plus more likely to get another one than someone who hasn't. So going back to Angus Brayshaw, the situation from last year, not to relitigate all of that, but that situation, if that's 99% of other players, significantly less likely to be concussed from that exact action, the way Braden Maynard jumped into him. So that's where the luck factor comes in. And you can't expect players to be doing that calculation in their head of how many concussions has this guy had, or is he more or less likely to be concussed if you can't. That's just a totally ridiculous way of thinking. I just think the AFL's got to get back to punishing that action. And that action from Peter Wright was not something I look at and think, wow, that's something we can't have in the sport. I would say that should be in the sport more so than George Hewitt punching Lachie Neale.
I don't disagree with that. And I think the AFL is clearly trying to drill into players that they do need to attack contests differently. And as I said, it's a changing game, and I think it's going to happen over a long time. We're going to see a lot of suspensions, but as much as there's a grey area here, I can see why the AFL are doing what they are doing. Jake, moving on to Thursday night's game, massive game. I don't think anyone really expected the Pies and the Lions to be winless at this stage of the season, albeit Brisbane's only played two games. The Pies are 0-3. This is a massive contest. Grand final replay, of course.
It's unbelievable, really.
It's crazy to think about. Who do you think needs the win more, Brisbane or Collingwood?
Well, I think Collingwood, it quite clearly, having, as you said, having played the extra game and having lost the extra game, they'll be 0-4. It would be one of the worst premiership defences of all time, and that's not an exaggeration. I think everyone would say Collingwood, whereas Brisbane would only be 0-3 and still have, I guess, that extra game to make up. But I'm going to say, I might surprise you and say Brisbane. I think Brisbane needs it more. So let's say this. Let's say both sides are 0-10. Down the line, they're both 0-10 this year. They're both just having disastrous years.
Yep.
Of course, both sets of fans are going to be disappointed. We're going to crucify these sides and say how terrible they are. But at the end of the day, there's one thing that Collingwood has that you can't take away. Last year's premiership. And no matter what happens this year, no matter how poor they are, no matter what we may think of Craig McRae or Scott Pendlebury or Steel Sidebottom down the line, you can't take away last year's premiership. And that's something you can't say for Brisbane. They don't have that premiership. They've been around the mark for for six-ish years under Chris Fagan, but just continue to fall short, obviously as close as you can get last year. So I think there's more at stake for Brisbane now, because a loss to Collingwood, obviously you forget the fact that you've lost to them again, a team that beat you in the grand final last year. But a loss to Collingwood would signal somewhat of an end of an era. And I know that sounds premature because it's only 0-3 and it's not 0-8.
Mm.
But all of a sudden they would have lost two straight at the Gabba. They didn't lose there at all last year. So that starts to open up questions as to, well, they're no longer are they unbeatable there. And I think it starts to, you start asking questions about is Chris, there's more pressure gets heaped on Fagan. Is he the man to take them forward? Potentially a new coach comes in. And this iteration of the Lions, as we know it, probably gets blown up to some extent through coaching or personnel.
Yeah, I do disagree, and I understand what you're saying, but just like based on this season solely, you don't play finals from 0-4.
You don't, so, but you really don't. I mean, 0-3, it's not like...
Even then, but the Pies are one game ahead of the rest of the competition beyond Thursday night,
yeah.
And they've played one extra game than Brisbane. They face the prospect of 0-4. If Brisbane win, they're 1-2, which is exactly where they were last year anyway. So I think this is a bigger game for Collingwood. As much as it's big for both clubs, I think they definitely need to win more.
But the you're Swans, saying if Brisbane win, they're 1-2, sure.
Yeah.
If so, Collingwood so win, not, they're 1-3. But if Brisbane lose, they're 0-3, and they've lost two at home.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's
I think
not,
that's
no, it's not ideal. I get that. But I still think Collingwood needs it more than Brisbane do. And we spoke about only last week the home games at the Gabba that they'll
yeah.
get. I think they'll be more confident that they can revitalise their season from 0-3.
I agree with that. I still agree. I think Brisbane's more likely to be, if there's only one, Brisbane's yep. the one that's more likely to turn things around.
For
but
sure.
I do think, and I see where you're coming from, the short term, this season
the
alone.
The Swans were the last team to do it.
2017.
They were 0-6, and then they went on a 14-2 run.
Yeah.
Which is extraordinary. It broke AFL history.
Yeah.
I think they were only one game out of the top four in the end. I believe that's the AFL era. I think North Melbourne in 1975 was 0-4 and won the premiership. But
yeah.
if we're taking a 160-year or whatever sample size, it's two teams that have done it. So yeah. you don't play finals from 0-4. And I think you spoke about the external noise and the pressure on the club at Collingwood just amplifies even more than what it is right now. And that first win just becomes tougher and tougher for them. I mean, Hawthorn in Gather Round, neutral venue next week, as much as we'll expect Collingwood to win, it's not the easiest game.
No.
Port Adelaide, then they've got a bye. Anzac Day's always tough. And they've got Carlton as well.
Yeah.
They're up against it, Collingwood.
Yep. And it sounds crazy to say, but if they do lose to Brisbane Thursday night at the Gabba, and you know, Brisbane, even with the horrible Tom Duday news that's broken this morning, should be winning that game. It's not beyond the realms of possibility that Collingwood could be 1-7, 1-8. Mm. And I mean, obviously then it is season over, but 0-4 really does signal season over in terms of winning a premiership, because it's not just about making finals and finishing eighth or sneaking in. You really do need to be making the top four, as we all well know. Another side that started without a win is Richmond, 0-3, as I predicted, and no one listened to me. Would that? Here's an interesting one. So Jacob Hopper and Tim Taranto, two of their premier midfielders now, two players that they brought in, started last year from the Giants. Would the Tigers, knowing what they know now, reverse those deals?
Oh, it's hard to say. They're not where they thought they'd be as a club, and they picked up those guys with the notion that they thought they were still in the premiership window, clearly. So hindsight's a wonderful thing, right? And at the time, it wasn't the wrong decision to make those trade acquisitions and bring those guys in. I can understand trying to squeeze as much out of the lemon as possible. But as I said, clearly in hindsight, they shouldn't have done it. We know that now. But would they be better served having those draft picks? I think it was 3 first-round draft picks, current and future, that were involved in those deals. Correct me if I'm wrong. But to bring in that high-end draft talent, maybe they would have been better served by doing that. But it's easy to say that now, that they should have.
Yeah.
So as I said,
but that's the question.
Hindsight's 20/20.
Would they, knowing what they know now, do it? That's the question.
At the time, they needed to bolster their midfield.
Yeah.
I can understand why Dimmer and their list management went down that route, but the question is, right now, would they change it? I think they might. Yeah, I think they definitely do. Let's not write them off completely either, by the way, because we're saying this because we feel like they're going to be potentially a bottom four team. They're 0-3, but while their squad isn't a squad that should be competing, and they're clearly not winning a premiership this year or anytime soon, there's injuries. They were good for three quarters against Port. They should have really beaten Carlton, even though they're not better than Carlton. They were really stiff to lose that game. I think they'll knock off some good teams this year, but the reality is they're just not that good. And maybe Dimmer knew that and he jumped ship just months after bringing those guys in.
What do we call... Well, that's another issue that I sort of raised last year, is that does more criticism needs to fall on Damien Hardwick for exactly that?
I think he's jumping off. He can get away with it because he's a three-time premiership coach.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think that's quite stunning that only months before leaving, you brought in Tim Taranto and Jacob Hopper on high-profile deals, thinking you're still in the premiership window. It's not working.
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to go. I'm burnt out.
And I think he took that long-term approach knowing that, look, let's be honest, what's the shortest sort of rebuild you can have? 3 years? 3 or 4 years in terms of you've been at the top, you're falling below, you're going to top up with draft picks and whatever players you can bring in from other clubs and then go again. That's best case scenario. Let's call it 3 or 4 years. Well, Taranto and Hopper are both going to be in their 30s and 31, 32, I would think. Is that too old? Now, I know it's not crazy old. But that's best possible scenario.
Mm. I wonder how they would feel.
So are they in line with the way in which this club, the trajectory we expect this club to have to take?
But remember, they didn't think they would need to rebuild. They went down the Geelong route of topping up with experienced players, which at the time was the right call.
Mm.
I'll say that again. So in hindsight, they made the wrong choice probably, but I can see why they went after those players at the start of last year.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Jake, plenty of milestones this season, and one's coming up on Easter Monday. Tom Hawkins will be playing his 350th game, champion of the club. But my question to you is Tom Hawkins the second best key forward since 2000 behind Buddy?
I think most people would scoff at that question straight away. But have a think about it. Write the names down if you have to that are in consideration for that number two spot. Because I think it's clear we're going to go Buddy one. Everyone's going to have Buddy number one and no one's going to take that away from him. But I don't think it's crazy that Hawkins is number two. And I know you're looking at me funny, like you're going to disagree with me. But let me just give you some quick numbers. I know it's not all about numbers, but it's soon to be 350 games, as you said, 349 at the moment, 786 goals, 1 Coleman medal, 11-time Cats leading goal kicker, 5 All-Australians, and the least important thing of all of this for this exercise, 3 premierships, but it does enhance his legacy more so than most others. But
at the Cats. Legacy at the Cats.
Well, I think legacy as a player. It doesn't. The premierships don't add anything in terms of how good you were as a player in my mind. But it improves it. But it does.
I don't think you should count to your premierships legacy as a individual accolade. Is that what you're saying?
I agree with that. But in terms of the whole package, you can't deny it. He wasn't the worst player on their list. He was a key piece of all three premierships.
Mm.
So the numbers are all there. Tick, 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 tick. The longevity, he beats just about everybody. Again, 350 games. Look at his performance last week. There's no... Every time we think he's slowing down, he reminds us that he can still be one of the best key forwards in the game because he doesn't rely on express pace or, you know, mobility and getting up the ground, he can still beat anyone in a one-on-one marking contest because he's such a strong guy.
Yeah.
And there are very few defenders that can actually beat him at this age, let alone when he was actually in his prime. He's had the individual success. He's had the team success. He's reliable. He's consistent. As I said, the longevity. I think he's been one of the most dominant key forwards of the modern era. And the modern era, I'll say, is 2000 onwards.
Yeah.
And I think, yeah, he is the number two key forward since 2000 behind Lance Franklin.
I don't disagree with everything you said about the champion player that he is, but I think he's just in the conversation of who could be second. And I'm looking at a lot of key forwards post-2000. The one that stands out to me is Matthew Lloyd. So 926 goals in his
career. Well, are you
looking
at Matthew Lloyd from 2000 onwards, or do you include the five or so years before then?
If you let me finish, you would have realised that in about 30 seconds' time. But 926 goals, as I said. But if you do want to look just beyond 2000s, it was 681 goals from about 180 games. It's a 3.6 goal a game average, which is far better than Hawkins, better than Josh Kennedy.
But you
Jonathan
also do
Brown.
Have to factor in. I know it's not a. It's not. You know, decades and decades and decades ago, mm-hmm. but it was a different game then, as we know. I think Matthew Lloyd.
I still think he's a better player than Tom Hawkins is. I don't think that's outlandish to say. I'd much rather Matthew Lloyd than a Tom Hawkins. I'd rather Jeremy
drafting...
Cameron than Tom Hawkins as a player. If we're talking about who's the best key forward, and it's not all about numbers and stats, but just about the footballer that they are, I'd rather Jeremy Cameron in my team than Tom Hawkins.
Now, Tom Hawkins, right now, or both at their best? Look, I don't necessarily disagree.
But Hawkins is, I'm not, you know, crapping on him as a player because clearly a star of the game, as you said and alluded to. But I think there's a lot of players that are in that conversation.
Yeah.
And that bunch of players for me, as I said before, Josh Kennedy, Tom Hawkins, Jonathan Brown, even Jack Riewoldt, if you want, you can put in that conversation
yep.
of
people would say Nick Riewoldt, Matthew Pavlich.
Yep.
Different
type of players yep. as well, different type of forwards. And you spoke about Hawkins and how strong he is. He's that one out in the goal square type of player. Clearly different to someone like a Nick Riewoldt who can play up the ground. Matthew Richardson perhaps as well.
I don't think there's anyone at all, including Matthew Lloyd or Richo or anybody, that is clearly better than Tom Hawkins in that time frame and clearly deserving of the number two spot.
Oh, he's clearly in that conversation. And 350 games, the only other one of those key forwards we've spoken about that did that was Buddy Franklin.
Yeah.
So I get what you're saying, but I think I'd still go with Matthew Lloyd. Two 100-goal seasons. You can't argue
with that. And again, we can't just look at the amount of goals kicked because it was a totally different game then. That's why scoring has dropped off. We don't get the 140 to 130 point games anymore. And as I said, it's not a huge amount of a long time ago, but it was a different game. The game was played differently. The way that the position was played differently. So I think
if Matthew Lloyd existed in 2020,
if Matthew Lloyd in 2007, Matthew Lloyd and Tom Hawkins came into the league, who would you rather have for that period of time?
Well, I would have liked to have seen Matthew Lloyd in the more modern game. That's for sure.
Yeah, see, I'm going Tom Hawkins.
Fair. But I asked you the question before, Cameron's or Hawkins. You can't argue he's 350 games and all these goals he's kicked and the champion player he's been at the Cats. But as a footballer and rating just him as a you know, in terms of his football ability and technical skill and all those sort of things, I don't think Tom Hawkins is number two as much as he is in the conversation.
Speaking of Geelong, Tom Hawkins' teammate Tom Stewart had a phenomenal game, we keep seeing this record tied, the intercept mark record. We spoke about it on
12,
Tuesday
12 players now.
With Christian. It's unbelievable. It's almost like they get to 10 and no one's wanting to take the 11th because they all want to share the record. But he was phenomenal, and we've seen similar performances from Sam Taylor as well, Giants defender. I guess it begs the question, the player that can intercept, an elite defender who can intercept mark, it's such a rare commodity to have in football these days. Has it become the most important player you can have in your team?
I think with the way the game is being played today, they're not the most important player, but they're one of the more valuable players. There's no doubt about that. I think midfielders will always be the most important, or the best players. They're the ones that you want around the ball more.
Mm.
They're the guns that are around the ball more. They're stopping the ball from getting in your back 50. They're getting the ball into your forward 50. But I think we're seeing that slingshot footy off the half back line, and a lot of scores being generated in the modern game from D50. And if that's not via putting on pressure and turning the ball over, it's because of these intercepting players that can then start those attacking chains from the D50. And you don't need to look at the stats to see what influence Tom Stewart or Sam Taylor has on their side and the way that they play a game of footy. We saw that on the weekend. I want to go through the last 9 premiership teams and where they've all ranked for intercept marks per game. So the last 9 of them have all been in the top 8 for intercept marks per game.
Mm.
These are the rankings. So in 2023, Collingwood was 6th. Then it's 3rd, 1st, 2nd, 6th, 5th, 3rd, 7th, and 8th. So the last 9 premiers all ranked top 8 for intercept marks per game. The last 4 premiers is 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 6th, which just tells you how important that statistic has actually become in the modern game. And a lot of these guys that have taken these 10 intercept marks per game, I mean, I think it was 5 of them in 2023. We've already got 1 in 2024. So it shows you how much more importance this position has. And I know we're only a couple of games into the season, but some of the top 8 teams for intercept marks already in 2024 are Geelong, GWS, Carlton, Melbourne, Gold Coast, and St Kilda. Sides that have actually performed quite well so far. But look, I'll reiterate, midfielders are the most important, but I think intercept defenders could be the most valuable.
I love Sam Taylor. I think he's the best. I think he and James Sicily are neck and neck for best defender in the league. Different players, but both phenomenal defenders and can do very different things. But let's be honest. Is anybody taking either of them over, say, Charlie Curnow? Is anyone taking
horses
them
for courses, maybe?
Let's say you're building a team from scratch, because this is the whole point of the exercise. Is what's you got to get the most important. You got your first pick. Is anyone taking Sam Taylor or James Sicily or Tom Stewart with their first pick when you can have any player? And it's not a shot at any of them. They're all phenomenal.
I don't think there's any harm in taking one of those. I mean, Collingwood just won a premiership with Brodie Miocek, who's a natural second or third tall, and Billy Frampton, who just came in and played a role down there.
Well, now look at them.
Yeah, but this is what I'm saying. The modern game now means you don't necessarily need that star key forward to win a flag.
I mean, no, but maybe
Richmond with Jack Riewoldt, they had a mosquito fleet of forwards when they won in 17 as well.
But they had Jack Riewoldt. Riewoldt was a three-time
great key forward, but I think it was low 190s, which nowadays the key forwards are a lot taller than that. So my point is, you don't need that big bullocking key forward.
Yeah, but I guess my point is, you may not need it, but you then need to be really good in other areas. So if you don't have the dominant key forward, okay, I'm not saying that you can never win, but you need to be great in other areas. So is it the great midfielder that you want? Is anyone taking Sicily or Stewart or Taylor over Bont or Petrarca? I don't think so.
Mm.
You tell me if I'm wrong.
No, your best players need to be in the midfield.
I've always said that, and that's why I've always been banging on about, you know, particularly Patrick Dangerfield when he was in his prime and being used as a forward, where he's not that good as a forward. With all due respect, his value is in the midfield, where he can be around the ball more, getting more touches of the footy, setting up the play. I mean, that's the thing. We spoke about this on Tuesday as well, just about getting your best players around the ball, where Isaac Heaney should play.
Yep.
The numbers will say he's a better forward than he is a midfielder, but don't you want him to be your eye tells you he's a damn good midfielder, and don't you want him to be around the ball far more than standing in the forward pocket and for 15 minutes and the ball doesn't come there?
Yep, no, I hear you, and it's a very good point and an interesting discussion. But moving on, Jake, in the VFL last week and the AFL trialed ball chip technology in the footies, just as a way of trying to improve the game. I guess, should we accept that human error is a part of the game, or are you a fan of this ball chip technology?
I love the ball chip technology. I'm excited for what it will bring to the sport, what it will add, and I guess how it will change the sport. And honestly, I can't wait for it to be introduced at the AFL level when that does happen. Should we accept human error as part of the game? Absolutely not. I mean, in some instances, there will be. The AFL is a very tough sport to officiate. So many rules, such a massive playing surface, so many things to be looking for, so many players. It's a tough sport to officiate.
I think it's the hardest sport in the world to officiate.
It might be. Yep. It might well be. That's with that said, like you're going to have issues with holding the ball. The way you interpret holding the ball is going to be, even if it's 1% different to how I interpret it,
yep.
It's just that will call, that will say, you'll say something's a free kick and I say something isn't a free kick. Or there's a lot of rules like that that are a little gray. Where we cannot accept human error in any way are things that are black and white. I'm not saying that we have to get, you'll never get to a point like where you can say every holding the ball is correctly paid 100%
and
throughout
the year.
That's
just part of
the game. That's just part of the game and open to interpretation. But the human error stuff that has to be right is the black and white bits and pieces, and that is stuff like scoring,
yep.
which we're taking steps in the right direction, but still obviously, you know, there's a lot of work left to do to get it to a standard that we think it probably should be at. And then other things like the ball, you know, look at Jack Higgins with the ball. We've got to get to a position where we know 100% of the time, is the ball in play? Is it out of play?
Yeah.
Just like goal line technology in football, where we see, yep, it's a goal, it's crossed the goal line. We know it. We know it's gone over by a millimeter. That's what we need to get in the game, and that's where we shouldn't accept anything less than 100% accuracy.
You're right. Accuracy is absolutely paramount in this game, and you're right. We need to get to a stage where knowing Jack Higgins was out of bounds is absolutely 100%. And you speak about football and goal line technology. You got the Hawkeye in the tennis, which can see whether the ball's out. And I know these are completely different games, but it's an idea of what we need to get to, especially when it comes to balls being out of bounds.
It's the black and white things where it can only be one or the other, and it's no gray, no middle area. And that's where we have to get better. At the end of the day, the AFL is a $1 billion industry. Right, the money is there to invest. Now, credit it's finally doing it, but we shouldn't be accepting anything less than this.
You can't have a Ben Keys incident like last season and just accept it, because that just compromised the whole integrity of at least that football match. So
Ben Keys, it's interesting. I was thinking about this recently. That's 2023. In 30 years' time, you know, we'll be telling the next generation about this, and they'll think that it must have happened in the 1950s for it to be missed, and for there to be no technology to be able to overturn it. Do you know what I mean? It just doesn't feel like it's possible
it's
for something like that to happen in 2020. Well, for that to happen in 2023.
Yeah.
But yes, we must get better at this. As I said, the AFL there's no shortage of funds and funding that can be put into this. And it's good to see that it is.
Yep. As I said, 2024, but you're right. There's no excuses to not be getting these things right.
Last question of the day. North Melbourne back in the spotlight on Friday night playing Carlton in a marquee match, a rare one for North. But I guess it does beg the question, with the Kangaroos having had such a poor record in recent years, are they deserving of that marquee fixture?
I think they are. I think it's okay that they have this game. Those bigger clubs like Collingwood and Essendon, Richmond, they get their fair share of annual blockbusters, and Carlton as well with the season opener. You don't always need two big clubs.
The season opener? Carlton get the season opener? Is that correct?
No, you know what I mean. the people's season opener, Jake. You don't always need
two
big clubs.
The round one opener.
But the reality is the AFL is still, as you said before, a money-making business, and having at least one high-drawing club is probably necessary. And I think that they found that out when North took on the Dogs on Good Friday. So from memory, North Melbourne had been campaigning for Good Friday for quite a long time. So I think they deserve that spot, regardless of how successful they are. I mean, Collingwood and Essendon aren't always the most successful teams, but they do put on a good show on Anzac Day. And I think the Good Friday clash just ties in well with the Good Friday appeal and other things. And I believe last year they had a record crowd of 49,000 plus. Now, a lot of that's to do with Carlton. They couldn't do that when the Dogs were involved. Carlton want to hold it. North deserve it. And I think it's a good one to continue as an annual game.
Yeah, look, I guess I'm not going to sit here and say, you know, North Melbourne should be stripped of this game. Yeah, they've been lobbying it for it for quite a while, as you mentioned. So I'm happy for them to have it. But if I am to play devil's advocate, even just for a second, is there some merit in saying that the teams that play in the marquee slots in these games need to be putting a good product on the field. And we know North Melbourne, 5-46 in their last 51 games, 13 of those losses have been by 10-plus goals. So the standard on field's quite poor. Everyone will agree to that. And I guess, yeah, is there something to be said that better teams deserve these slots? And that's not just to knock North off its perch. I mean, that could be said about all these games. I know Anzac Day has a long history, Essendon and Collingwood. Do they deserve... And I don't know what the answer is. Should we be more open to rotating teams through that are playing better?
I don't think so. I think we've seen it work with, you know, the Anzac Day games and the usual season opener between Carlton and Richmond. I think North deserve this game, as I said. I don't think it necessarily needs to be the most successful teams playing. And I think it works really well with North Melbourne. They're going to be a pretty good team.
As you said, they are leaning on Carlton quite a lot because...
With the crowd attendance, yeah. And the AFL will love that. And that's why I think these two clubs work. Carlton are going to be good for a while. And I think North are going to become good. The AFL know that. I think this is going to be a really good annual clash to come. It was a longer episode today. There was plenty to get through as we discussed, but that is all we have time for. Thank you for joining us for another episode. Have a safe Easter, enjoy the footy, and we'll speak to you next week.
Thanks for joining us on the ESPN Footy Pod. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.